We will be looking at four areas in which Jesus shows his power. His power is seen in four unique areas. And in a way which can become a great encouragement to us no matter what we're going through. And I think that is so needful. So often we forget just how God can make a difference in each situation that we face. And some of them are tough. These situations kind of run the gamut because we're going to see Jesus express his power over the elements as he stills waves on the sea. We're going to see him exercise power over the demonic realm as he casts a demon and a number of demons out of a man. We're going to see him exercise power over sickness as he heals a woman, and we're going to see him exercise power over death as he raises a little girl from the dead. God is amazing in his work, and in this chapter, Luke kind of coordinates these things together so that you can have faith in who he is, so that you can see him for who he is and the response that's so needful within our lives. Let's jump into verse 22 where we left off. It happened on a certain day that he got into a boat with his disciples there on the Sea of Galilee, probably up in the Capernaum region at this point where he was left last. He gets into a boat with his disciples and he said to them, "Let's cross over to the other side of the lake," which is really what the Sea of Galilee is. Though it's called a sea, it's a large freshwater lake, about 13 miles by 7 miles wide. It's a great body of water. It's surrounded by mountains, 680 feet below sea level. And a very beautiful climate year-round there. And as they crossed over, it says they launched out, but as they sailed, he fell asleep. Now, I just want you to remember what Jesus said there, because that's going to come into bearing here. He said, "Let's cross over to the other side of the lake." Now, remember that. That'll come into play later. Well, as they launched out, as they sailed, he fell asleep. Being weary, Jesus, constantly ministering, took advantage of a little bit of an afternoon nap, and took a nap on this little boat. But as the windstorm came down on the lake, they were filling with water and were in jeopardy. And they came to him and awoke him, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." Now, at least some of the disciples were experienced fishermen, so they, I would imagine, have tried everything they could to get this boat under control. But the wind and the waves were as such that it just hit them. Now, that is not an unusual occurrence there at the Sea of Galilee. Because of its situation with Mount Hermon up to the north, going up at about 9,000 feet above sea level, and then down through the Hula Valley into this gorge, that's a gorge that's part of the African Rift Valley that goes all the way down through the Dead Sea, then all the way down into Africa. The Dead Sea in the Sea of Galilee is 680 feet below sea level. The Dead Sea is 1,400 feet below sea level. It's not unusual because of the short distance and the temperature changes for great winds to come right down like a funnel in that valley. And it's a very powerful thing that can happen. Now, I would have a difficulty thinking that this little lake, only 13 miles by 7 miles, could ever have waves big enough to threaten a ship, a boat, until I saw with my own eyes and experienced one. A couple of years ago in Israel, we were on one of those tourist boats that they make, and you know it holds probably about 75 to 100 people, and you could take about that many people over, and so it's a big boat. Even that big boat was tossed by the wind and the waves, and you would have to see the video that we got. It's incredible. You know, as we're huddled up under our raincoats and our umbrellas, and the wind and the way the waves are coming up over and splashing people, and it's going up and down and up and down, and this big, huge boat. So it doesn't surprise me that they actually feared for their lives in that little tiny boat that held probably 15 people. This is their assessment of it. Notice, it was filling with water and they were in jeopardy. So panicking, they did what they thought they had to do. They awoke the master. They woke Jesus. Now, of course, being experienced fishermen, they may be wondering, "Well, I don't know what he's going to do. Let's just wake him and tell him we're going to die." So he knows, and he doesn't go down in his sleep. So that's what they say, "Master, Master, we're perishing." Now, the amazing thing is, I think they made a mistake to wake him. I think this was a lack of faith, as we're going to see it really was. Because Jesus didn't say, "Let's go out into the middle of the lake and drown." He said, "Let's go to the other side." Now, when God says something, you can pretty much assume it's going to happen. It will happen. Although there will be many reasons why in your own life you'll wonder whether it really possibly can. Bible says all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to His purpose. Do you believe that? Are you in that calm ship, then all of a sudden the storm comes and you wonder whether that promise can really be true? Then you know what the disciples felt. Well, He arose and rebuked the wind and the raging of the water, and they ceased, and there was a calm. All of a sudden, He gets up and He rebukes, and in fact, the other gospel account tells us He speaks to the wind saying, "Peace, be still," literally, "be muzzled." And it's the same word that He uses when He casts demons out of a man. He tells the demons to be quiet. He's speaking to the winds and the waves. Now, this could possibly be because there was a demonic source for this particular storm. Perhaps Satan stirred it up trying to destroy them. How foolish can you get being a creature that God created to try to destroy God? Satan was blind enough to think that he could try it and get away with it, but how blind and foolish of him. He could never. Now, when Jesus calms the storm, He turns to them and says, "Where is your faith? Where's your faith?" You see, God had spoken. He's with them. He's got purpose. Jesus has already given them the kingdom parables and the whole plan of God and what He has in store for the coming kingdom. Did they actually think it was all going to go down in the middle of the Sea of Galilee? Did they think it was all over? Did they forget who they were with? Well, now He's reminding them. And sometimes, thankfully, the Lord reminds us just who's in control, just what He's up to. Well, they were afraid, and they marveled, saying to one another, "Who can this be? For He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey Him." So now they've got an education. They've been enlightened. Their eyes have been opened. And we have the advantage of looking back on this time through this story and seeing, wow, Lord, You are in control, even of the weather. Now, the next situation ties into this because you see Jesus shows power over the waves. Now, He's going to show power over the demonic realm. Let's look at the next story. They sailed now. They get to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, which is opposite Galilee. It's actually, if you go from Capernaum on the northwestern slope of the Sea of Galilee or the area of the Sea of Galilee, you come southeast, you'll come to the area of the Gadarenes. There's a kibbutz there in the area that serves some awesome St. Peter's fish. And we go there each year. It's an awesome time. But we take a little bus ride just a little bit to the north, and we come to that area where they believe the Gadarenes were. And it fits well, the geography that's described in the scripture, with what you have out there, this steep incline down into the lake. Well, when they stepped out on the land, there met him a certain man from the city who had demons for a long time. And he wore no clothes, so he came out naked, and he did not live in a house but in the tombs. This man was an outcast of society. He was possessed by demons, could not socialize with people, did not get along with people, and so therefore lived out in the caves. The tombs were often just caves that either you found a cave that you could use as a tomb or you actually carved one out of the rock. This man was out there among these, living in the caves. He was a cave dweller. He was a literal troglodyte, one who dwelt in caves. Amazing how modern science discovers the remains of these people who dwelt in caves. They see the paintings and the primitive tools, and they develop a whole fantasy world of their being our ancestors. How can you make that assumption when there were people living in those days that lived in caves, but they were oftentimes outcasts of society, not normal people? So why do you assume that these were our ancestors? I think that's quite a leap of assumptions there, and that unfortunately happens many times when you get science in the picture because it's got a certain bias. But here's this guy. Now, I just want you to feel where he's coming from. He's out there in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out, and he fell down before him, and with a loud voice said, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." Now, really, it wasn't him speaking, but the demons, because we are told here, for he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. As soon as he saw the man, he saw him in his condition. He commanded the spirit to come out. And now the spirit has responded by saying, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For it had often seized him, And it was kept. He was kept under guard, bound with chains and shackles, and he broke the bonds and was driven by the demons into the wilderness. So these demons were tormenting him. Now, it's important to realize that some people believe that this was a chemical imbalance, that really there's no such thing as demons. People will point out that even today you see people who are bipolar, who have various chemical imbalances that resemble these types of things. And I don't doubt that, but the fact is, though there are certain ailments that can resemble this, it shouldn't surprise us. For instance, even if a person was on drugs and was, you know, filled up with PCP, he would have super strength and he would just be wild. You couldn't control him because the PCP, the drug, deadens the pain receptacles in the nerves, and so he doesn't feel any pain. So he can do great acts of strength, just as this man did when the chains and the shackles could not hold him. He broke them. Somehow the possession of the demons were able to bypass those pain receptacles. Now, when you look at the demonic world, there's a lot we don't understand. The Bible gives us bits and pieces, and we're told not to delve into it any more deeply than what the Bible reveals. And unfortunately, there are people that don't listen to that, and they have their books on demonology, and they try to describe to you all the background and the origins and the workings of demons and how they work and how you deal with them. And I think it's funny because all you can do is piece together certain things. The fact is, there are these entities called demons who have a tendency to want to have some human contacts, to have some material connection, though they themselves are, you know, not material, spiritual. They also have a fear of the abyss, being sent into the abyss or the pit or the place trapping the angels that did not keep their first estate. And I believe that, however, it's an assumption for us to say about demons that they're fallen angels. That is an assumption that we make. It seems to be right. When Lucifer fell from heaven, in Revelation it says a third of the stars from heaven fell with him, meaning a third of the angels fell and they became fallen angels. And of course, there are fallen angels. But are demons fallen angels? That's the jump in logic that people make. There's not really a clear understanding of that. Some people believe that the demons might even be the spirits of the Nephilim, the people who were born in the time of Genesis 6, that were perhaps the offspring of a union between demonic beings and people. And that when the flood came and destroyed all those people who were of a hybrid nature, they weren't human, so they could not be redeemed. They could not be bought out of their sin or even suffer as a human. But their spirits wandered the earth, and that these make up and comprise the demonic entities. Well, we don't know. But one thing we do know is that the Bible speaks to show us that Jesus had authority over them. He had the power to consign them to the pit. He had the power to cast them out of people. And also, we need to know later on, when we find people receiving the Lord, and of course the Holy Spirit comes upon them, He promises to give them power over the demonic realm. He says, don't rejoice because you can cast out demons, but rejoice your name is written in the book of life. But know that you also have that power. I think if you understood fully what the Lord has done in your life as a Christian, You wouldn't be afraid of the demonic powers out there. There are certainly real powers, but you ought not to be afraid of that. In fact, they're afraid of you if you really know what's going on. See, because you represent a threat to their kingdom of darkness. Satan wants to keep his kingdom of darkness intact. He wants to keep it from anyone escaping that kingdom of darkness into the marvelous light of the Lord. And so he does anything he can to oppress and depending on what culture works best. Over here in America, we don't see a lot of demon possession because in other countries, primitive countries, that they, you know, he uses that as kind of a fear and intimidation thing. But in America, he's got so many people wrapped up with materialism, it doesn't matter. He'll just let them go in that delusion, whatever delusion he can keep you in the kingdom of darkness. But you as a Christian, empowered with the gospel of Jesus Christ, going forth, as Jesus said, go in all the world and proclaim the gospel. Make disciples of every nation, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and lo, I'm with you always. You've got a great promise to go, and that represents a threat to the domain of Satan. So he'll try to bluff his way into your life and make you think that he's really got you and he's got power. Jesus said, all power and authority has been given over to me. And greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. You ought not to fear demons. You ought not to fear them at all. They have no power over you. And you need to understand that. Well, this man, in this condition, Jesus asked him, saying, what is your name? And he said, Legion, because the demons had entered him. And they begged him that he would not command them to go out into the abyss, that he would not push them into that place. Now, a herd of many swine was feeding there in the mountain. Of course, raising pigs in Israel was not a lawful occupation, but there was such a large Gentile community in the area that certain people saw it as an opportunity to make a profit. So they begged him, that is the demons, they begged him that he would permit them to enter them, and he permitted them. And the demons went out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd ran violently down the steep place into the lake and drowned. The pigs weren't used to that kind of control, so they just, committed suicide. I'm sorry, couldn't help it. This is the first case of deviled ham here that we see in the Bible. Just want to make sure you're with me here. But in that particular area, there is a gradual slope, and then it gets steeper and steeper until it comes right down into the sea, and that's probably the place this happened. Not to mention there is a church that goes back way back in the 5th century, that tradition has it, that was in the area. Well, those who fed them saw what had happened, and they fled and told it in the city and in the country. And when they went out to see what had happened, they came to Jesus and found the man with whom the demons had departed sitting at the feet of Jesus, great place to be, clothed in his right mind, and they were afraid. They knew this man. They freaked out. They saw what was going on here. And they who had seen it had told them by what means he who had been demon-possessed was healed. And the whole multitude of the surrounding region of the Gadarenes asked him then to hang out, because we love that kind of stuff. No. Amazingly enough, they asked him to depart. Notice from them. For they were seized with great fear, and he got into the boat and returned. Amazing to me, as powerful as Jesus manifests his control over the demonic realm, as amazing as that was, instead of evoking a response in people that was appreciative of him, they send him away. Now, some have argued that it wasn't really right for Jesus to destroy someone else's property. Well, he really didn't. He just allowed the demons to go into the pigs. I think that was a better option than allowing the demons to run around and possess somebody else. And that the pigs went and destroyed themselves was certainly a better option than having 2,000 demonized pigs running around. So you've got, the only other option. The point is, too, it becomes a very strong case to prove that something did dramatically happen with this man, that it wasn't just a matter of sickness, that there was an entity there. This guy wasn't bipolar. He wasn't like schizophrenic. He wasn't, of that nature. This was something that was demonically in origin. There are people that have those particular ailments, and they're not demon-possessed, though they can have certain tendencies people begin to wonder, and there's a lot of spirituality behind that. I believe that this man, it was a proof through the pigs running down that something dramatically happened. You couldn't see the demons actually leave, but you could see the man coming to his right mind, and all of a sudden the pigs go crazy. But the people, what is it about them? I look at the land of the Gadarenes, it reminds me of our media-driven culture, which is more interested in the profit that it can make off of people and would willingly see thousands caught up in violence and drugs and sexual promiscuity, if it means profit for them. They don't care. I think this is a warning to every producer and every actor and every writer and musician and director that the things that they participate in would be wholesome rather than something that would degrade people. But it's unfortunate that degrading things sell. And so they certainly would not want Jesus to interfere with their profit. A revival in this nation would put a lot of people out of business, And there are people that would fight everything they can to keep that from happening. It's unfortunate. Jesus, of course, is not going to stay where he's not wanted. If you don't want him in your life, don't worry, he'll stop knocking. But woe to you if you come to the end of your life and you don't hear from him. They sent him away, and he did not argue with them. He went in the boat and returned. And when the man from whom the demons had departed begged him that he might be with him, Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your own house and tell what great things God has done for you." Since Jesus is going away, at least he can leave this man there to testify of what happened. And he does. And so this man, according to the other gospel account, goes not only to his hometown, but goes through all the 10 cities of the Decapolis, telling what great things God had done for him. And literally, in many of those places that Jesus could not get to, he had this man testify in his right mind, altogether, now speaking of the things of God. Well, he went his way and did this. Now, it was when Jesus returned that the multitude welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. Now, here's the picture. You know, they left, and the people are over there, and the crowds that followed Jesus were all bummed. Oh, Jesus is leaving. But they're watching the boat. They're watching the boat on the other side. And they could see the boat over there. They're watching it. They're going to make it. Maybe he'll come back. Maybe he'll come back. And they've got some spies that are just watching him to make sure, okay, you keep an eye and wake me up if you see him come back. Well, sure enough, you know, after he performs that miracle, they get in the boat and the boat starts coming back. So the word spreads, he's coming back, he's coming back. And by the time Jesus gets there, a whole multitude was there welcoming him, waiting for him. That's where I want to be. I want to be in that group. I want to be eagerly waiting for the Lord. Well, behold, there came a man named Jairus, for he was a ruler of the synagogue, and he fell down at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house. For he had an only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. The synagogue that Jairus was a ruler of, we don't know. It's possible this could be Capernaum, and it could be the very same synagogue that Jesus performed the miracle of healing the man with the withered hand. Now remember, when he did that, he didn't make friends because they were quite offended that he did a miracle of healing on the Sabbath day. And in their minds, in their traditions, he violated the Sabbath day because he did work. So they were not happy with him. It's possible that this ruler of the synagogue was not happy with Jesus when he was first there. It's interesting, however, when you have a real heartfelt need, you tend to overcome your former biases and prejudices. And here now, this man has a need. The little sunshine, his little joy, his little 12-year-old daughter is now sick, lying frail and limp and hurting and facing death. And he knows that Jesus has power to do something, so he humbles himself and he goes and he falls down at Jesus' feet and begs him to come to his house. He couldn't imagine seeing his little beautiful little daughter die. That would break his heart. Now, the centurion actually sees, we see in that man, remember when he believed Jesus could heal by just saying the word, shows that he had much more faith than Jairus, because Jairus actually needed Jesus to come. But the Lord was not offended by that. He will do it according to your faith. If you don't do it just right, or if you don't, everything's not just right, it doesn't mean the Lord is going to reject the way you're approaching him. He accommodates for our weakness of faith so often. That's our Lord. So he goes with this man. And as he went, the multitudes thronged him. Now, the word there in the Greek is a strong word, literally strangled, that there were so many people jostling for position to get around him. You couldn't, I mean, he was being squeezed and strangled. Now, a woman having a flow of blood for 12 years, who had spent all her livelihood on physicians and could not be healed by any, came from behind and touched the border of his garment, and immediately her flow of blood stopped. Now look at this woman's plight. For 12 long years, she had this condition. It wasn't just a condition that could be easily concealed either. It was an obvious condition that affected her socialization with others. It's quite possible that she was rejected, she was ostracized, she was segregated from the people. It could be even that she was divorced by her husband, because he would have certainly not put up with that for 12 years. And she has it in her mind that if she can just touch the hem of his garment, the tassel, really, literally, the 4 tassels that were commanded the Jewish people to wear in Numbers, she grabs a hold of one of them. When you see the Orthodox Jewish, so the ultra-Orthodox Jewish people today, they wear the four tassels and the little knots in the tassels. That comes from that Numbers passage. And that's what this woman not just touches, but grabs hold of, literally. So she's holding on. And then she feels that she's been healed. Now Jesus stops and says, "Who touched me?" When all denied it, Peter and those with him says, "Master, the multitudes throng and press you." And you say, "Who touched me?" I mean, how can you tell? Everybody's pushing against you. But Jesus said, "Somebody touched me, for I perceive power going out from me." Now, Jesus wanted to make sure this woman came forward. For a couple of reasons, I believe. Because he knew that this woman touched him, and perhaps her faith was that very shaky faith of superstition. She believed that there was power in the actual physical act of that rather than the purpose and will of God being behind the faith. See, there is a difference between being superstitious and having faith. Being superstitious is attributing power to inanimate objects, like, you know, opening up your horoscope and saying, "Ooh, you know, the position of the stars is going to actually directly affect me." Foolish, stupid, superstitious. You know, if you walk under a ladder or a black cat crosses your path or you spill salt. I was rather amused with a relative of mine that we were having dinner in California, and one of the kids spilled salt and he grabs the salt and he throws it over his shoulder. And I said, "What do you do that for?" He goes, "Oh, it's just superstition." So I knocked the salt over for fun to see if he'd do it again. And he threw it over there and I knocked it over again. I just want to see how long this would go on. After about the seventh time, he was getting rather annoyed with me. So I could see that he was not going to give up. So I said, all right, I won't do it anymore. But it just, you know, amazing what people will believe when they don't believe in God. This woman had almost a superstitious belief that if she could just touch the hem of his garment. Now, God accommodates her. You see, I love that about the Lord. There may be certain things that we don't agree with, you know. There are certain things that people put faith in this or that, and maybe thinking that, well, there's some help in holding on to a crucifix or standing in the healing line and getting touched by a man of God or something, and they put faith in those things. But oftentimes, those may be just an opportunity to release our faith. So that we really just say, "Lord, I'm waiting for you." Now, Jesus stops her to let her know of his heart and what really saved her. It wasn't the superstitious act. So, when the woman saw that she was not hidden, in other words, Jesus wasn't letting this go, she came trembling and falling down before him, and she declared to him in the presence of all the people the reason she had touched him and how she was healed immediately. And he said to her, "Daughter, be of good cheer. Your faith has made you well." He wanted to make sure that she understood that it was her belief in him that saved her. It was that belief in him, go in peace, or go literally into peace. Now again, I believe sometimes, you know, we come to the Lord with a weakness of faith. We've got our superstitions or ideas, and you know, we've got our opinions, and many times they're not very biblical in origin, and yet the Lord still accommodates us. So often graciously. But as we grow in him, he expects us to know what's really going on. It's nothing magical in the act of saying a prayer to receive Jesus in your heart. It's simply an expression of your desire to let him be Lord. And you're opening the door of your heart and he will come into you. He will be your Lord. Now while he was still speaking, someone came from the ruler of the synagogue's house. Now put yourself in this ruler, Jairus's heart here, and you know, he is very anxious that Jesus should come home and heal his daughter. He knows his daughter doesn't have much time, and Jesus, come on, we've got to hurry. And it might be that he's very impatient at this little delay, and he's like, come on, you know, what's this woman doing? You know, come on, Jesus, my daughter, she's dying. Or it could be after the woman was healed that he was ecstatic. He could have been like so excited, like, oh, Jesus just touched that woman and she's healed, and I just heard her say she's healed, and oh, this is so good. He's on the way to see my daughter, and oh, she's going to live. I'm so happy. And then he gets this piercing news. Your daughter is dead. Don't trouble the teacher. I can imagine that pierced his soul like a knife. that all of his joy and hope and anticipation of Jesus coming now is just gone. It's just like it just hits him and he can't quite think of what that means yet. It's like he doesn't want to believe it for hope, but he hears the word. When Jesus heard it, he didn't let the man stay in that state for very long. He answered him saying, "Don't be afraid. Only believe and she will be made well." Boy, I imagine that must have hit him hard. Don't be afraid. Now we see he has a basis for his faith. Jesus said it. Don't be afraid. She'll be made well. Now he can believe. Don't ever take belief or faith out of the context of Jesus' promises. It's important that you do that. Soon as you come to a place where you say, well, I'm believing God for this or I'm believing God for that. And I've heard people in their various traditions say it like that. Well, I'm believing God for a new car. I'm believing God for a new pair of shoes. I'm believing God for this. I had a pastor friend in Africa that was of this persuasion, and he spoke about how he believed God for a new pair of shoes, and the Lord gave him a new pair of shoes. And I said, really, how'd that happen? He goes, well, I told my congregation, I'm believing God for a new pair of size 10 and a half shoes that are brown with a little wingtips on them, and I'm believing God's going to give them to me. Well, the next morning, they were at his doorstep. He's like, thank you, Lord, for giving me these shoes. No, God didn't give you those shoes. Your little manipulation of the people gave you those shoes. You know, you little dropped the little dime, and of course someone felt sorry for you, so they went out and got you a pair of shoes. But his whole mentality is, I start with a pair of shoes, and then I work my faith up so I can believe God for a Cadillac. I'm sorry, but that is a perversion of what belief is and what Jesus is saying. Belief needs to have the object of its faith. You can believe all you want. Well, you're on a sinking ship, that ship won't sink. I believe it's not sinking. I believe it's not sinking. Glug, glug, glug. Yeah. It's going down if there's a hole in it. But if you have a promise from God, that ship is not going to sink. You can have 20,000 holes on it, and guess what? That ship won't sink. You've got a basis for your belief now. Don't make the mistake of trying to believe something because you think there's power in the belief itself. Do you understand what I'm saying there? That is very important. Because people do that. They think the power is in the belief, so they're going to try to believe. I believe, I believe, I believe. Jesus said she's going to be made well. You've got now a basis to believe. Only believe, for she will be made well. Don't be afraid. Now this man, I believe, you know, at that point, he's got nothing else to hold on to. I believe he was holding on tight to that hope. And when Jesus heard it, he answered, when verse 51, he came into the house, he permitted no one to go in except Peter, James, and John, and the father and the mother of the girl. Now all wept and mourned for her. But he said, do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping. And they ridiculed him, knowing that she was dead. Other gospel accounts tells us that actually people were laughing him to scorn. So here they are mourning. Probably the professional mourners were there on standby, and as soon as the child died, they go into their wailing and mourning and, you know, the horrible lamentation that they will bring up. And, you know, this whole thing just to, I don't know what the purpose of it was for, but that's what they did in their tradition. And Jesus comes in and says, don't mourn. She's not dead. She's only sleeping. Now, he knew very well she was dead. But you see, as far as he was concerned, it was only temporary, so she's sleeping. Same thing he spoke about Lazarus. Lazarus had been dead 4 days, but he told his disciples when he heard Lazarus was sick, the sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God. In other words, it won't end in death, but he died. Well, it won't end in death. So for all intents and purposes, she's sleeping. Well, that infuriates the people there who were very well knowledgeable of life and death and knew when the little girl had expired, she wasn't breathing anymore, her heart had stopped, and they ridiculed him. But he put them all outside. Now, why does he do this? Why does he make this so secretive? With the man that he heals or casts the demons out, he tells him, go and tell people what God did for you. This time, he tries to keep it low key. He put them outside. Why is that? I think the obvious is the fact that he's already in a place where multitudes are thronging him. And in some places, they try to make him king. He doesn't want that type of notoriety. He wants to continue to minister and help people. He doesn't want a bunch of looky-loos hanging on to see something exciting. You know, he wants people to really minister to. Where in the Gadarenes, he couldn't be there anymore, so it was okay to spread the news and tell everybody so they could hear. So he put them outside, took her by the hand and called, saying, "Little girl, arise." And her spirit returned, and she arose immediately. And he commanded that she be given something to eat, and her parents were astonished, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened. Notice his word. First of all, his word of encouragement, "Fear not, only believed." Seemed a little late, perhaps. Nonetheless, he tells this man. Then the word of revelation, "She's not dead, only sleeping." He knew something that they didn't know. And now the word of power, "Little girl, arise." And the little girl arose, her spirit returned, she arose immediately. And then he commanded. You ever wonder why he commands after a healing or raising someone from the dead? It seems like this always happens. He commands that they give the person something to eat. Is there something about death that makes you hungry? I don't know, but I think it's possible this removes some of the freaky aura about seeing someone dead come to life. It's like, you know, the parents are like, "Should I touch her? Is it real? You know, I mean, this is something. I mean, she was dead and now she's alive. Is it a ghost? What's going on here?" You know, Jesus just saying, "Hey, give her something to eat," kind of brings it back down to the homey, "All right, she's hungry now. Give her something to eat." Gives the parents something to do anyway. Well, he charged them to tell no one what had happened. Again, that charge not to let this thing get so broadcast to hinder his ministry. But he knew that the sufficient evidence of Peter, James, and John would eventually give us the report, which they did in the gospel account, so that we would have this, that we would also know that Jesus is powerful. So Jesus has done all things well, and he does today. He showed power over the elements, over the weather. He showed power over the demonic realm. He showed power over sickness. He showed power over death. And each time there is a response that's needful on the people's part. When he shows the power over the elements, he wants his disciples to rest in the storm. Oh, that we would rest in the storm. You know, Christianity will always be surrounded by a storm. It'll always be something. In church history, when you look at the storms of the past that have hindered so often, it seems, people, but actually they just test the resolve of people. You know, are you going to believe him? Even in the midst of the storm. There's darker periods coming than there was in church history. If you think the dark ages were bad, the delusion the Antichrist will have in the tribulation period with those people left on the earth after the rapture, it will be astounding. Dark times will come. Our part should be rest in the storm. No matter what persecution, no matter what difficulties you're facing, God has a purpose. I think the response for the demonic man is well taken. The people should have received him well into their territory, even though they lost a prophet. Hey, it's okay. We can lose a little money here. We've got a man here that is more than a man. He's much more valuable than our puny little prophet from the swine. And I think the lesson there, and of course with the man who was willing to go where Jesus told him to go. Then we see the response from this woman. The thing that strikes me more than anything about that is the fact that she pressed through the crowd. You see, that to me is a very telling statement. Because I believe that there are obstacles in your path that Satan always puts up to keep you from coming to Jesus. But God uses those obstacles to test your resolve to see how badly you want him. You know, you come to church and you'll see someone you don't like or someone that did something wrong to you. And you can get offended at that and take your eyes off of Jesus because of that situation. Press through the crowd. You'll see hypocrites. You'll see problems. You'll see difficulties. And it's hard to find, you know, fight the crowds here in the second service when you come to Calvary anyway. You know, press through the crowds to see what the Lord might speak to you. I believe that was the lesson, the response that was needful for her. And she does that. And she's rewarded. And this final illustration is trust, even against all hope. There'll be times when you think all hope is lost, but that's not true. It only appears that way because you have a greater promise that all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. You can know that he will perform what concerns you. And I believe looking at Jesus showing his power in each of these areas is an encouragement for us to respond to him positively, to rest, to receive him, to race to him, and to realize that he's in control.